Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. This is the first Dhamma discourse of the 2001 Vassa, or Vassa Vassa, the rainy season retreat. Usually at the beginning of the retreat periods, I usually spend time just going over the basics of meditation. However, this evening I was so inspired once again by the sutta we just chanted, the Dhammacakka Sutta, the turning of the wheel of the Dhamma, that I'm going to discourse on some of the Dhamma which is revealed in the first discourse of the Buddha. And also there's much in that discourse which gives information about how to be more successful in our meditation. It gives the groundwork, or rather the ground plan of the Dhamma. And you cannot distinguish or separate the Dhamma and the practice of the Dhamma. In the same way that you all know one of my favorite gathas from the Dhammapada is, there is no wisdom without jhanas, there is no jhanas without wisdom. And there again the Buddha is showing that the path to deep meditation, you cannot separate that from the understanding of Dhamma, the understanding of the mind, the world, and what makes up this illusory existence of ours. And certainly the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta gives a lot of very powerful and useful information for us in our practice of meditation. And very often that when I start a retreat, I do ask the question of the disciples, what was the first teaching of the Buddha? And very often they make the mistake of saying it was the Four Noble Truths. And I point out to them in the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, before the Buddha started talking about the Four Noble Truths, he taught the middle way. And it's very easy for us to just to pass over that preliminary teaching as if it was just an overture to the main course of the Four Noble Truths. But that middle part was a very profound realization of the Lord Buddha under the Bodhi tree. Well, I would actually say it was an insight which occurred prior to him sitting under the Bodhi tree, where he reflected upon many years of austerities and understood that that was not leading anywhere near to the realization of Dhamma. And it was the memory of his experience under the rose apple tree as a young boy, when he entered the first jhana, that struck him at that time. And the memory made him exclaim that perhaps that's the way to Bodhi, to enlightenment. And the realization came that was the path to enlightenment. And to point out that it was that experience of jhana under the rose apple tree which the Buddha was referring to as the way, the path to Bodhi, and confirmed that and repeated that in the suttas. And as a result of that, knowing that that path of jhana was essential, was the path to Bodhi, that the consequence of that was realizing that if the body is too weak with austerities, if it has got too much pain, or if it is just too fat with indulgence, that you cannot reach those jhana states. And so he realized the middle way. And that middle way, he says, is between the Atta Gilamata Anuyoga. Anuyoga means, you might even say, attachment to, indulging in again and again and again. I like the word attachment to the word Anuyoga because it literally means yoked along with. It's like two bulls would be yoked together on a cart. But it's usually interpreted as what you practice frequently. And indeed, what you attach to is what you would practice frequently. And he was saying the practice, the Anuyoga, Atta Gilamata. Gilamata means to tire, to weary, to weaken. And the Atta is one's self, in this case the body. The weakening, the tiring of oneself. He said it's not the way. And so that we should reflect, you know, in our daily practice of meditation, just what is needed to keep the body and the mind. It's not just the kaya getting tired, but also the mind getting tired. We want to find a way of not being too austere on our body and on our minds. So it means that we eat enough, but not too much. We sleep enough, but not too much. We talk enough, but not too much. And we're kind to our body. Sometimes people think that this monastery has got, is too well supported, it's too soft. But if you look upon what is necessary to get good meditation, then that is the right level. I know someone was talking to me earlier on, they'd just been reading the Patipada book, and all the austerities of the Kubarajan, which they read in there, sort of put them off in a sense that was much more than they could do. But I say on the tape here, on the record, that I stayed with many of those famous Kubarajans. And the reality of life with them is they were very kind. And they were very supportive. And their monasteries, even those days, many of them were as luxurious or even more luxurious than this monastery here. Even certainly the food which I got at Ajahn Mahabua's monastery, Wat Bantat, 25 years ago, or 22 years ago, sorry, was even more than we get here. And these days it's ridiculous how much food one gets there. And I always look to Ajahn Mahabua and to what he did as a guide to how I run this monastery. One of the stories which they told me at the time, which showed me just how much that he went out of his way to bring physical comfort to his monks. At that time, that people did not know the health effects of cigarettes. However, many of the monks, including the Western monks, would smoke those cigarettes in the monastery. Again, this was many years ago, and it was common for monks to smoke. Ajahn Mahabua himself didn't like smoking, but nevertheless, whenever he would go out into town to a dana or to some function or to visit some relations, he would make a point of always smoking one cigarette in front of the lay people, so that they would see this great monk smoking cigarettes, and so they would offer him heaps and heaps of cigarettes. That was the only way that he would get cigarettes to give to his disciples, his monks at the monastery. And that was like a sacrifice for that monk. He thought that cigarettes were needed by those monks and were not going to be an obstacle, you know, to their meditation. That's what he thought was the middle way. I'm not sure if you find that story in the Patipada, but hopefully it balances what's necessary and what's needed for the success in meditation and success in insight. It's a middle way. It's not just, obviously these days cigarettes is known to be bad for your health, and it's not a good thing to do, and it's certainly banned in this monastery. But other comforts, until we find out they are bad for the health, they are allowed to keep you comfortable. But to keep the body comfortable, that's why we have heaters in some of the huts, And if those heaters improve your meditation, turn them on. If they make you too sleepy and the meditation goes all over the place, turn it off. So these are there to sort of try and help you find that middle way of comfort for the body. The way of austerity just makes the body tight. When that body is tight, like the simile of the lute, too tight, it cannot make a good sound, and the body cannot make that beautiful sound of deep meditation. And you can tighten that lute up, tighten your practice up yourself. And you know how you tighten the strings of a guitar or of a piano. You tighten it and then you pluck it to see what the sound is like. And if it's, you know, too high or too low, then you adjust it accordingly. And this is how you find that middle way with the body, by always making constant adjustment to how much you sleep, how much you eat, and how much you indulge the body. You have to give some indulgence. That's the middle way. So if you try and just, you know, be hard on this body, there was this one monk in England a long time ago, Kapalawatu, or something. He was one of the first monks who went to England. He read in the suttas about the Buddha, who even in the cold nights, even the sutta says even when the snow fell in India, he would just sit outside just in three robes. So he decided to go out on Hampstead Heath in London just with his three robes and spend all night there. He had to be in hospital with pneumonia for many days afterwards. That was not the middle way. So don't sort of follow that example. Follow that example when you can look after the body enough to be able to let it go. But also the Atta-Glamatana Yoga also refers to the mind. Don't go tiring the mind, or hurting the mind, or being austere on your mind. That is why that we practice loving kindness, metta, not only to our fellows in the monastery, but also to ourselves. That metta softens the mind, gives us kindness to the mind. If ever, when you're meditating during this retreat, you feel yourself again getting tight in the mind, in the same way you get tight in the body, then find ways of relaxing. The simile which I've been using in lay retreats and also monk retreats is to remember always to give yourself playtime. This was simile from school. If you imagine a child having to go to school and go into the class from 8 o'clock, the next lesson straight afterwards, right till 3:15 in the afternoon, without any break, it would be a waste of time. The child would not be able to learn. Even if there were a university, they would not be able to learn. Just the brain would just give in and would just go into dullness or fantasies. And education, psychologists know that by giving yourself a break, the mind becomes bright afterwards. So from time to time, just use your mindfulness to remember that middle way. And if you find your mind sort of going a bit crazy, it means you should have some playtime. By playtime, I don't mean going around seeing how much chocolate you can get from the kitchen, or just drinking cup on cup after coffee, or just whatever else, or reading the newspapers. There's no newspapers here anyway. What I mean is like going, have a walk around the monastery. Just go and sit on a rock and just watch the sunset. Just do something which is peaceful, which is conducive, but which is not trying to get somewhere. Sort of relax. Because very often, Westerners in particular, try too hard. It's a result of their control freak psychosis. And each one of you has that. And we always want to just, you know, get to Nibbana right away. We want to go there rather than be there. We want to sort of go on to the next stage rather than be here and allow the present stage to come in from within. just like the simile of a spring feeding the water right from its center. All these dharma, this jhana, these insights are right inside you, even now. You just have to allow the mind to go in, not to go on. So it's not attaining something else. Well, although in one sense it is attaining, but in the reality it's not attaining going on to something else, getting something you haven't got. It's going in. Now, you all heard me say many times a simile of the lotus. That lotus is right here. Just needs to open it up and see what's inside. You don't need to get another lotus. That's why I always say that each one of you has what it takes to experience Nibbana. In the simile of the lotus, Nibbana is right inside you in this moment. That insight, that knowledge, that awakening of the mind. It's all covered over. That's why we cannot see it. So, be gentle with your mind. And in the practice of meditation, that's why you should not force the mind. I've tried forcing the mind. I've seen other monks force the mind. I've seen monks sit so still with sweat coming down their faces. And they're the ones who usually disrobe. They try so hard. They cannot last the course. They cannot maintain that for very long. And it's also that of all these years I've been meditating and looking at my mind, I realize that's wrong. You don't get to deep meditation that way. And you see the first teaching of the Buddha saying, of course you don't get to meditation that way. That's Atthagiramatthanu Yoga. The opposite, Kamasukhalikanu Yoga. It's Kama Sukha. It's the happiness of the five senses, of the body. It's so important to know what that word means, Kama Sukha. Because a lot of times people always say that it's attachment to this, attachment to that. It's only the attachment, the cravings for this physical body, for the pleasures of the body, for the pleasures of sight, sound, smell, taste and touch. To give up those pleasures or that comfort and go for the pleasure of the mind. That pleasure of the mind is what's in between the pain of the body and the pain of the mind and the pleasure of the body. It's the one thing which is left out from the two extremes. That's why when the Buddha was talking about the middle way and what was between those extremes, he was pointing specifically to the pleasures, the joys of the mind. In particular, the joys of jhanas. That is the middle way. That's why he reflected back on the time under the rose apple tree. This is the path. It's not enlightenment, it's the way to enlightenment. He was pointing out the way, avoiding those extremes. And later on when he told what that way was, it was the Eightfold Path which culminates in Samma Samadhi. And it's very true to say all those other factors are what supports and leads to Samma Samadhi, the jhanas. So the middle way between those two extremes, to me, it points, it means, it is the practice and realization of jhanas. Away from Kamasukha. Not concerned at all with the body anymore. Apart from the things which tire the body and tire the mind. What tires you? Or what brings energy? What sort of keeps you sort of to this world, keeps you down, keeps you close to the ground of sensory experience, and what allows you to rise up into the heights, the stratosphere of deep meditation. This gives you an idea of what this middle way really means. But when the Buddha completed saying about the middle way and saying it was the Eightfold Path which culminates in jhana, by saying that, he showed what are the supports for this practice. Now, from samadhiti, the right view. Again, that is just so important. The view that you are responsible for your karma. Now, which means that you cannot blame anybody else. You cannot blame me, you cannot blame your fellows in the holy life, you cannot blame the anagarika friends, you cannot blame the cats, you cannot blame the visitors to this monastery, you cannot blame a god, you cannot blame the government. It's your karma. You did it, you get the results. So often we waste time blaming other people, thinking if we could only get a better teacher than Ajahn Brahm, if we could get better friends, and that person sitting next to me, if we could only get a better anagarika, wouldn't it be wonderful if next year we actually hired a cook to look after the kitchen? And then I wouldn't need to go in the kitchen at all. Wouldn't it be better if we had enough money, we could have a butler for every monk who would come to your hut early in the morning. Breakfast, venerable sir. Is it to your liking this morning? Tomorrow would you like marmalade instead of jam for your toast? And what would you like for lunch as you give your order from the menu? So you wouldn't even need to come out to the hall. Wouldn't it? You could go on like this, couldn't you? How you could make the perfect monastery, every monk having a servant, and every anagarika also having a servant. So you wouldn't have to do anything, you just tell the servant what to get you this day. All those sort of, that's missing the point. Now the point is that it doesn't matter what's outside, it's your reaction to it inside which is important. The right view says it's not his fault, it's mine. Doesn't matter what a person says to you, no matter what a person does or doesn't do. So it's up to you to be able to let that go. Part of the training is to allow karma to disappear by not holding on to the past. Whatever anyone says about you, whatever anyone does, as soon as it's done, as soon as it's said, allow it to disappear. Like the simile which I gave in my book of the padded cell. A padded cell mind means a sensory impression, like the sound of somebody else, hits the mind. But in a padded cell, it just sinks into the padding and never bounces back. It just gets swallowed up and disappears. Don't have a ping pong mind where you hear something and it bounces in your mind hour after hour, day after day. What that person said, they shouldn't have said this. What should I say next? What should I do? I've got to tell someone about this. This is really horrible. This is rotten. Don't have a ping pong mind. Have a mind like a padded cell. All sensory impressions, you know, feelings in the body, sounds in the ear, smells, tastes, touches, even things in the mind. As soon as they've arisen, you know them. As soon as they've passed away, you let them go. And I mean to really let go. They just disappear into oblivion. Why not do that? Why do people keep hanging on to the past? A lot of times, as I've said, it's fear. Fear of what would happen if you really let go. We measure ourselves by our past. It's self-view again. Atta, me. Who are you? Who do you think you are? All the definitions of who you think you are, all about what you did in the past, where you went in the past, what you achieved in the past. If you let go of every part, moment from the past, your whole history, who are you then? So much of the sense of self disappears if you can let go of the past. And with that sense of self disappearing comes all the hurt and the pain which comes from having an ego. Let go. It's not that hard. Have the courage to try it. Having tried it, feel what the result is like. You feel this is so good, so nice. People can call me all sorts of names. As soon as they've stopped talking, can't remember what they said. It's their problem, not mine. So we can let go of all of that. Sammāditti, right view, to let go of things. It's not, don't go blaming things, people, getting angry at them. Don't even hold your past faults. This is again one of the reasons why people can spend a lot of time on retreats getting depressed and angry at themselves. The same way you can get angry at other people, why? Because you hold on to the past. Even what you did. What time do you get up this morning? Who cares? It's now the evening. Even if it was 25 past 6, just enough time to roll out of bed and get to the breakfast. Doesn't matter, that's gone. I'm not going to tell you off. Please, you don't tell yourself off. You probably needed to sleep. Be kind to yourself and don't carry around ill will towards yourself. I don't want you to do that. None of your friends want you to do that. Let go of the past, be free of it. You're allowed to let go of every moment of the past. And you find that you'll get much further, much deeper. You become much wiser, more attained if you can do that. So don't allow yourself to get into depression, ill will towards yourself, guilt, and all these other psychoses of the mind. Free yourself from those things. It's not that hard to do if you can know how to let go of the past. And this is right view. The view is that you can do this, it's allowable, it's good to do this. The right view of the world, which is actually wrong view according to Buddhism, you must feel guilty. You've done something wrong, what do you feel about that? Come on, feel guilty. Suffer. That's what my parents wanted me to do. If I made a mistake, they wanted me to suffer. Go to your room, suffer. Can't watch the TV today, go on, suffer. It took a long while of rebelling against that idea. If you do something wrong, you always need to be punished. I've rebelled against that now, so don't do that to myself anymore. If I make a mistake or do something similarly, do something wrong, I don't carry it around with me. I drop it straight away. Acknowledge, forgive, learn. And that way you're free of the past. And you don't waste time during this retreat. But sammāditti is so important. Sammāsaṅkappa. Now the right thought, the right intention. Often, I was pointing this out to someone recently, the first of the right sankhapas is nekamma sankhapa. Actually, it was last week at Nolamara. Nekamma is renunciation. It's like the thought of letting go. It's the mind which inclines to letting go, especially of, because the opposite of nekamma is karma. Kalongama. Karma vitaka, thoughts of the body, thoughts of the five senses, thoughts of sensuality. That's the thing which is wrong for you. So when we use our mind, we're always looking at how can we let go? How can we abandon? How can we give up things? What more can we give up? So you become a giving up junkie. See what you can throw away, see what you can burn. That's why I love my stone outside my room. I can let go of so many bits of paper on that stone. And for me, being an avid, so the paper is my enemy. All these faxes which come demanding my attention, disturbing my meditation, all these letters which I have to read and answer. But they all get capital punishment, burnt to death on my stone. Whoopee. All these books I have to read because people send them to me. Marvellous, I can burn them to death. I get a lot of fun out of that. The reason I get fat out of it is because they're going to cessation, they're disappearing. And all those words and all those ideas and all that papancha in all those books, it all ends up as just black, like gone to hell. It all burns in a fire. That's what hell is like, the fiery place. So that's where all ideas go, they all end up in hell. Silence, the quietness, ends up in heaven. So that we have this wonderful idea of just letting go, giving up. And that's what you try and do in monastic life. See how many things you can give up. See how many things you can get rid of. Your possessions, your past, your future. Give up your future. Who cares what's going to happen tomorrow? Now let's just look after this evening. Live for today. That's my motto. Live for the moment. Live in the moment. If I can do that, one is practicing Samasankhapa. No ill will. With compassion and kindness. No violence. That's all the right thought. And these are necessary to start getting samadhi coming up. All of the right speech, right action, right livelihood. Your sila, your precepts, your virtue. It's quite easy to be virtuous in this monastery. There's nothing much you can do wrong. You're living with some of the best quality people in the whole world in a monastery. When you come to sort of looking at the standard of people, the standard which you find in a monastery, the sort of people you can live with here, which is so nice. And if you don't believe me, come on a Friday night to Nolamara, and those are really great people there. And just, but still, the standard is much lower. The standard of trust and kindness, you know, their nobility. And you go out in the world and you see what happens there. And it's gross sometimes. But over here, if you can't live at peace with the people in this monastery, if you can't be friends with these people, there's very few people better than this. This is why the value of virtue, of kindness. I haven't got it in for anybody in this monastery. I think you're all great. I was saying to the Anagarikas last night, I'm very proud to have such fine people in this monastery. And I respect every one of you. And I'm not just saying that, that's true. I respect everyone's commitment to nobility and precepts. You're all great monks, or great monks to be, one of the two. Or great nuns to be. And so I respect everybody, and that's because of your virtue. And you get mindfulness, effort, and then samadhi itself. Remember, the mindfulness is always remembering as well what you're supposed to be doing. Remembering that you're supposed to let go of the past. You know, remembering that don't get caught up in what these other people say about you. You know, remembering the instructions on how to meditate. Well, the Buddha started the Four Noble Truths. They weren't just teaching the Dhamma, they were teaching how to meditate. You know, what is it? Sort of suffering. And birth is suffering, old age is suffering, sickness and death is suffering. What is birth, old age, sickness and death? This is body. Saying the body is suffering. Because you're either just been born, or you're old, or you're sick, or you're dead. The four possibilities, the four postures of the body. In another aspect, you've been born, you're sick, you're old, or you're dead. The four bodily postures. You're in one of them, or maybe two or three, I don't know. But whatever, this body is suffering. And that should really point you in the right direction to meditation. In other words, if you try and get happiness in this body, even when you find the best posture, you just can't do it. No matter how many cushions. Now that Buddhism has come to the West, you've got these all these Westerners with great papancha. They're probably figuring out the best cushion and the best meditation stool. And in a few years we'll get the high-tech cushions. But no matter how much research there is, as Buddhism becomes popular in the West, they're never going to be able to find a cushion or a stool where you can sit comfortably. The nature of the body is like this, to hurt, it's suffering. That should tell us that the way to overcome that suffering is to give up this body, let go, don't be concerned with it. Aches, pains, itches, coughs, just look after it the best you can, but it's hopeless, you know that. Just sit down and forget about it. Just watch the breath. Go into the breath until you leave the body through meditation. Don't try and escape from the body through pills or sleep. Can't get rid of it that way. Get rid of the body through meditation. Apiyehi sampa yoga dukho, piyehi vipa yoga dukho, yampi changa lapati tampi dukhan. So being with what you was not dear to you. What do you really like in this world? What is really precious to you? You can't have it. Whatever it is. Not me saying that, it's Dhamma saying that. It comes to you, but then it just disappears straight away. Whether it's the nicest place in the world, a place you want to go to, something you need, something you want, a dear friend, just wanting things of the world, you can never quite get close enough to possess them. So you have to let these things go. Just things of the world are just ephemeral. They're unsubstantial. They're liars as well. They're liars because they promise happiness but give you suffering. Everything in the world is like that. Whether it's a wife or a husband, a child, a parent, a home, a car, a bank balance, fame, whatever it is, they're liars. Why do people want to become famous anyway? They think they've made it. They've got their picture on Time magazine. They've got there. So what? It's just more trouble, more problems. Well, this is just letting go of these things. These five khandhas, suffering. And say the upadana of these five khandhas. The upadana means taking these things up. The word attachment should be given to another word, upadana. Upa and adana, taking up these five khandhas. That's suffering. When you take up body, suffering. Take up any vedana, that's suffering. When you get into vedana, experiencing things, that's suffering. Sanya, all perception, it's suffering. Thinking, suffering. Even being conscious. Vijnana is suffering. There's a passage in the Sutta Nipata which says, Yankinchi, I think it's Samudayang, no, Yankinchi Dukang Sabantang Vijnana Pachayang. That whatever dukkha is in the world, it's all caused by Vijnana, consciousness. Very powerful. With the cessation of consciousness, there's a cessation of dukkha. Powerful abbreviation of the dependent origination. That's in the Sutta Nipata. What that means is that, you know, we realize from those Four Noble Truths, or the First Noble Truths, that being conscious is being suffering. So it tells us what this meditation is all about, is just giving up consciousness, letting go of consciousness. And that's hard to do, because even when we sit in meditation, we want to hear, we want to feel the body. We're actually attached to these consciousnesses. Why? Is because that gives us our identity again. When we feel the body, we are. At least we think we are. You know, when we hear a sound, we're being something, we're doing something. Listening to a talk, you're doing something. It's not as boring as being in your hut all day, trying to stop everything. But we have to let go of this consciousness. And you might well describe meditation as a way of letting go of the consciousness. So I said that the mind is two parts, the doer, the controller, the control freak, part one. And the consciousness, the knower, the experiencer, that's part two. The way of meditation is samatha, calming down to the point that they disappear. Calming down the doer until it ceases. It's not there anymore. You're not doing anything. You can't do anything. When you do, you move. With the cessation of all doing, all controlling, all making, all building, all coming, all going, there's no cause for any more movement. The mind becomes still, one-pointed, samadhi is reached with the end of the doer. And that's further to go yet. Get rid of the knower, consciousness. And that's the job of the higher jhanas. Little objects of consciousness, and with it the consciousness which experiences that, disappears. Disappearance of the five senses, the five sense consciousnesses in the first jhana. Little by little, the mind conscious, mano vijnana, the jitta. You experience the jitta disappearing. Gets less and less and less and less. Until it fades completely away. Even the jitta ceases. Cessation of all perception, all feeling. You know a thing by what it does. This is understanding the First Noble Truth. Why allow consciousness to cease? Because it's suffering. Why allow the doer to cease? Because sankhara is suffering. Chaitanya, one of the great sankharas, the sankhara kanda, it's suffering. To see that these five khandhas are suffering, are dukkha, is a powerful incentive which allows the mind to let go. What we are attached to, we don't see as suffering. What we keep playing around in, we never see as suffering. You all know that famous simile of the worm in the pile of dung, whose friend tried to pull the worm out but wouldn't go because he thought the pile of dung was wonderful, so nice, so delicious, so aromatic. I should be careful there, because someone told me the other day that as soon as I've built my cave, they're going to import some bat shit from somewhere, because they've heard that I like the smell of bat shit. It's only because I spent 6 months in a monastery in the north, where I spent a lot of time in the cave there. Lots of bats there, and I associate the smell of bat shit with that wonderful time of nice meditation in the north of Thailand. So to me, bat shit smells lovely. Just because I associate it with meditation. But the worm associates the dung with its food, with its home. And so you can't pull the worm out of there. In the same way that what we think is happiness, it's hard to pull yourself out of what we think is happiness. With all the will in the world, unless you realize that thinking is suffering, thinking is really dukkha. And silence is much nicer. If you can experience that, or at least have faith in that, then you can stop thinking. How can you stop the mind? Through realizing the end of thinking is an end of dukkha. An end of a great deal of dukkha. Not total end of dukkha, but an end of a lot of dukkha. Why can't we get into jhanas? Because we're still attached to this body. There's still this body with its senses we think is fun. And we're scared of getting rid or letting go, allowing to disappear. The controller, the doer. So close to our sense of self that we just will not get rid of it. Now this is just even the First Noble Truth, let alone the Second Noble. I'm going to go off to the Third Noble Truth, because the practice of meditation, the practice of letting go, and as I was pointing out in this last year, just contemplating these noble truths, you can get so much, you know, Dhamma juice out of them when you squeeze it a little bit. The third Noble Truth is so powerful for knowing how to meditate. The Second Noble Truth says if you crave for sensory comfort, then you're never going to get anywhere except more suffering. The three types of craving, kama dhanha, the craving for sensual existence, bhava dhanha, the craving to be, and vibhava dhanha, the craving to destroy yourself. And the Buddha said that the ending of those cravings is the ending of suffering, the Third Noble Truth. Specifically, Chaga, Patinissaga, Muti, and Alaya. And I've contemplated those. I've turned those four ways of letting go into my meditation. When you talk about letting go as a path of meditation, now the Buddha knew letting go so well, he had four different ways of letting go. So try these in your meditation. If you want to get still and peaceful and free the mind, practice chaga, practice patinissaga, practice muti, practice analaya. Chaga means giving away. Chaga is generosity. If you're generous to other people, give them the benefit of the doubt, ill will cannot come up. Be generous in your judgments of others. Be generous in the judgments of yourself. So don't be hard upon yourself. Patinissaga. This is throwing things away. See how many things you can throw away, as I was saying afterwards. So in your meditation, what can I get rid of next? What can I get rid of next? Always throwing things out of the mind rather than trying to accumulate more. Meditations is about how little you can have in the mind, not about how much. So it's emptying. I used a simile recently about the hot air balloon. To go high, you have to throw something else out. You throw out the ballast, and then you throw out the basket and just hang on to the strings. Then you throw you out, and then the balloon goes way up there. See if you can now throw the balloon out. And you sort of, it goes up to infinity. Everything, there's always something more you can throw out of the mind. And if you have that perception of seeing how much I can throw out, and you cultivate that perception of patinissaga, and the mind is inclining towards patinissaga, throwing out, relinquishing, you will find that automatically the mind will go through all the stages of meditation, because it's inclining in the way which leads to the very deepest of meditations. If that's the inclination of the mind when you get into the first jhana, that patinissaga will be empowering the mind to be able to go into the second, third, fourth, the rupa jhanas, maybe even into the way of cessation. Because it's the way of letting go, giving up. You cannot give those orders within the jhanas. But if that's the way the mind has been inclining, if that's the way it's got into the first jhana in the first place, that inclination, that, if you like, the movement of the mind, even though the mind's not moving in jhanas, just the word movement, inclination, the theme in the mind at the time, will be what causes the jhanas to develop deeper and deeper as more and more things just slip away. And you're letting go. It's patinissaga, beautiful way of not only getting into deep jhanas, but giving up all that is burden. Everything you own is a cause of suffering. Your physical possessions are a cause of suffering. Your body, which you own, if you think you own it, is suffering. Your history, if you think you own it, is suffering. Your future, if you think you're going to own it, is suffering. Thoughts in the mind, suffering. The experiences through the senses, suffering. If you think you own them, don't own them. Don't add a mine to these things. Patinissaga, throw them away. If you throw all this away, you know how to end suffering. Patinissaga. Muti. It's a word of being free. What's it like to be free? Have you ever experienced freedom? What's the greatest freedom you've ever felt in your whole life? When you've got lots of possessions, do you feel free? When you've got lots of duties, do you feel free? Where are our duties anyway? It's what you've got to do next. What you've done already. That's duties. In the moment there's nothing. Freeing. So I mentioned in the talks, the core meaning of freedom is contentment. When you're content, you're free. Free of desire. Free of that which makes you move. You're free of the prison officer who's always telling you what to do next. Desire, craving, is your torturer, which leads you to execution of death. So don't follow the torturer. Just escape from the torturer by having no desire, no craving, but instead having contentment. Contentment is the tunnel which leads you out of prison. If you're content, you're not in prison anymore. The difference between being free and imprisoned is not where you are. It's not what's going on. It's not how you're feeling. It's not what object is in front of the mind. That does not make you imprisoned or free. The difference between being free or imprisoned is just whether you want to be here or you don't want to be here. Whenever you want to be here, you are not in prison. You might be in Alcatraz, San Quentin, or in Karna Prison Farm, or in Bodhinyana Monastery. If you don't want to be here, you are in prison. In any of those places, if you're quite happy to be there, if you're content, it's no longer a jail. It's no longer a prison. You are, in that moment, absolutely free. If you're in pain and you don't want to be here, you're imprisoned by that pain. If you're content and let the pain be, not trying to escape from it, not wanting to get rid of it, but fully embrace it, you're free. Free from the pain. If the mind is going all over the place, you don't like it, you're in jail. The mind's going all over the place, and you let go, you're free, and you'll find all that commotion inside will vanish. Contentment is letting go. The opposite of craving is freedom. Just like you're releasing a bird. Free. But analia is that when you've released the bird, you throw away the perch. You destroy the cage. You chop all the branches off from the trees. So that bird has got nowhere to land. The mind, when it hasn't got a resting place, nothing to attach to, nothing to crave for. The ego, the self, the mind, the citta, it's got nowhere to establish itself. The mind, you, the knower, the doer, it needs something to establish itself. It needs a perch. It needs something to attach to, a person, a thing, an idea, an experience, a realization. When you take all of those perches, all of those resting places for the mind away, nowhere to land. What does a bird do then? It flies and flies and flies, getting more and more tired, more and more weak. Analaya, no resting, no perch for the defilements. The defilements get weak and they die. Analaya, no rest for the defilements. No perch, no place where the sense of self or where craving can find a footing. It's how letting go happens. It's the end. When you don't have a place where thought can land, thought disappears. You're silent. when you don't have a place where the senses, the five senses, can really establish themselves. Five senses disappear and you enter jhanas. You don't give these five senses a landing place, a mooring. They die. And this mind, the knower, you don't even give that any space at all. It dies. Cessation. Nibbana. So please remember the Third Noble Truth. It's a very beautiful teaching of the Buddha. The four ways of four ways of letting go. Chaga, Patinisaka, Mutti, Analiya. So when you're meditating, when you're practicing, try that. Chaga, be generous. Patinisaka, whatever is a problem, just throw it away. Don't matter what it is. Don't even read the letter of suffering. Why that you're hurting now. We always write letters about our experience. Throw it in the bin straight away. Whatever's happened to you, whatever someone has said to you, whatever's happened in the past, whatever you feel, whatever you've done so far today, all in the bin. Patinisaka. And Mutti. Doesn't matter where you are, what you're listening to, what you're experiencing. Be content. It's good enough. This moment here, this body, this mind, so content, all craving to go somewhere else disappears. All craving to do something else. All doing ceases with contentment. A mind which is content doesn't speak to itself. The inner thought goes. The mind which is content comes to stillness, comes to emptiness, disappears. Mutti, freedom through contentment. And Analiya, please don't give any place for the craving, for the defilements, for the knower and the doer. Don't give them any place where they can come back and build up a home again. House builder, you've been seen. You will not build up any more houses. No more existence in samsara. Enough. So when the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, I even didn't really go through the second one, maybe 3 weeks time when we chant this again. He taught not only the Dhamma, he taught the way of meditation. He taught the whole practice. Such a beautiful teaching. So it's marvellous we have the opportunity to chant this during the rainy season retreat. When you're chanting it, reflect upon it. If you're not actually studying Pali, at least know what the Dhammacakka is in English. So when you come across these words, you get a feeling for them. So they inspire you, uplift you, direct you, and free you. When Kondanya listened to that, he became a stream winner. Isn't that wonderful to become a stream winner? So understanding this powerful teaching of the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutra, first sermon of the Buddha. I think that's enough for this evening. Has anyone got any questions? Yeah. One of the important factors of being able to let go is seeing the danger, the adinawa. Indeed, and the danger is like dukkha. Either, you know, you're building up dukkha for the future, you're building up dukkha in the present moment. That's the danger of all these things. So that's, you know, understanding it, seeing the danger through the Four Noble Truths. But of course, to see the danger, you also need to see the escape as well, the nisarana, from these things. And to see the escape from these things means to experience just the beauty, the peace, the happiness, the freedom, and all these things have gone and disappeared. So it's true, the adinawa, but also the nisarana, the escape. body contemplation to see the danger, see the dukkha in it. I was thinking that body contemplation, but as I was remarking that even doing anapanasati, just doing the meditation on the breath, in the Anapanasati Sutta, the Buddha specifically said it fulfills the body contemplation. It fulfills vedana contemplation. It fulfills citta contemplation. Fulfilling means that completes. It's all you need to do. So even doing the Anapanasati, just to the first four stages, the Buddha specifically in the Anapanasati Sutta said that fulfills body contemplation. But if you cannot do those four stages, then maybe you should reflect more on this body, to be able to see its danger, its suffering, its futility, its uselessness, so you can actually let go of this concern for the body and its five senses. Okay, thank you for those.
Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho Sāng.